Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the March 6th Forum featuring Rob Manfred, Commissioner of Major League Baseball. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Rob Manfred, Commissioner of Major League Baseball, engaged in a fireside chat with Sam Kennedy, President and CEO of the Boston Red Sox. The conversation focused on the future of baseball as they touched on a variety of subjects, including labor relations with the players, international expansion, free agency, gambling, regional sports networks, and the league's commitment to fighting ALS. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
Not sure how I feel about this assignment. Warren has asked me to interview the Commissioner of Baseball in front of the power brokers of Boston, my bosses, John and Linda Henry. And the subject of today's interview, if he doesn't like my line of questioning, actually has the power to ban me from the game. So Warren, let's give this a shot. Commissioner, sit down.
Before you start, I mean, let me deal with two things right out. And, you know, I'm going to put you to work. This Yankee rumor. Let me talk about that for a minute. I did grow up a Yankee fan. The first baseball game I ever went to was on August 10th, 1968.
Check your mic there, Rob. Give me a hand signal from the dugout.
The green light's not on.
How about that?
There you go.
Ah, there you go. All right, so the first baseball game I went to was August 10th, 1968. My dad was a big Yankee fan. My mom and dad drove my two siblings and I down to New York for the weekend, and we saw the Yankees lose on Saturday 3-2 to the Minnesota Twins. But Mickey Mantle hit two home runs that day, one from the left side, one from the right side. It's the last time he ever hit two home runs in a game, so I had a great Yankee introduction. Now this is the part Sam's going to have to handle. There's something about my job that would cure you of being a Yankee fan. Sam can explain what that is to you. Okay.
They say there's some things that are inside baseball.
Well, right. We'll leave that one. The second thing I do want to I want to thank Boston College for the Pete Frates jersey. You know, sometimes people do things and, you know, brings back a memory for you. The very first thing that I did, it was literally the first day back after I was elected, is about 250 of our employees stood on Park Avenue and took the Ice Bucket Challenge. So it was, you know, an important beginning to my relationship with the organization. We ended up making a really great relationship, not only with Pete, but with the entire Frates family. So thank you very much. A meaningful gift from my perspective, certainly.
Well, we've already started to address the elephant in the room, but before we get into the substance of the conversation, I do have to ask you one more question. As a Yankee fan, what has it been like to hand that World Series trophy to John and Linda, Tom, Mike Gordon, and the whole crew four times?
Yeah.
Four times in the last 17 years.
See, so I did go to law school. I don't accept the premise of your question, okay? I was actually delighted to hand the trophy to John and Linda. And Tom last year, you know, it was a great World Series. I think my only complaint about it, I was absolutely convinced after the 18-inning game that we were coming back to Boston. That was my only grievance. You know, the outcome was fantastic. Glad to see the Red Sox win. I think it was really good for the sport. But I could have used one more game at least.
A game five, game six at Fenway.
Would have been pretty good.
Would have been okay. Well, look, you are, I believe, the first Major League Baseball commissioner who actually played Little League baseball.
I did.
Growing up in Rome, New York, how does a kid go from roaming the fields in Rome, New York as a Little League baseball player to becoming the highest ranking official in our game? How does that happen, Rob?
Well, you know, a lot of people who work in sports kind of aspired to work in sports, and truth is, I never did. The first, one of the summers I was in law school was 1981. I worked at Morgan Lewis in Philadelphia, and I was actually lucky. The night before the 81 strike began, somebody at the last minute gave me Phillies tickets, right? So I went to the ballpark, and I'm standing in the will call. It's when everybody still did will call and all that. So I'm standing in the will call window, and it was the night that Pete Rose was poised to break the National League hit record. So I'm standing in will call, right? And I hear this huge roar, and it became clear when we got in the stadium, Rose had gotten a hit to tie the record. So I'm thinking, this is great. I'll still get to see the hit where he breaks the record. Well, long story short, Nolan Ryan was pitching. Pete struck out four times while I was there. And the next day, the players went on strike. That was it for baseball for a good part of the summer. And I can remember standing in the office saying, you know, I really like my labor relations and my baseball separate. And you know, it's kind of, I just vividly remember having that conversation. But I got lucky. Baseball came to Morgan Lewis as a client. I was literally assigned to work on the case as an associate. You know, went through a set of negotiations in the winter of 89-90 as kind of the young lawyer on it. Unfortunately, was the last lawyer standing at the end of the 94 strike, and baseball really became my client. I decided to go in-house when they made Selig the permanent commissioner. I mean, that was really the event that changed my mind about going inside. And I thought that there was a chance with stability in the commissioner's office to kind of break the cycle of a strike or a lockout every time we negotiated. I was lucky. I brought some really good people with me from the law firm, and you know, we made three labor deals. Commissioner Selig was great to me about broadening my portfolio. Kind of odd, you know, the labor guy becomes, and I really was the labor guy, becomes the eventually the CEO. But he broadened my portfolio as we went along. And, you know, after a very long day in Baltimore, I managed to get to the 24 votes that you needed to get elected. You know, I got off to a strong start. I got 22 on the first ballot. Unfortunately, it took six more ballots to get the last two guys.
We all mentioned this, who you might be running against. That's in our rearview mirror.
Well, look, the truth of the matter is, after the first ballot, I was running against and nobody but me, right? I mean, I was left out there alone. But
well, you talked about broadening your portfolio as a CEO, and on behalf of everyone in this room, I think we can all agree we've all benefited from mentorship or people that have guided our careers and helped us along the way. I'm sure you've had several mentors. Give us a sense of some of the folks who have really played a key role in your development as an executive.
Well, let me mention just three people. I said Commissioner Selig originally. You know, he spent a tremendous amount of time with me over the years, helping me understand the management of 30 owners, 30 bosses. He had a unique advantage that he always impressed upon me, that he came from the ranks of ownership. And, you know, learning how he handled the group, I think, was important. And then, you know, as I said already, gave me great opportunity. I mean, things that people said, you know, why do you have Rob on that? He's the labor guy. And he put a lot of faith in me. And You know, I still talk to Bud, you know, at least once a week in terms of finding out, you know, what he's thinking about what I'm doing and what issues I'm facing.
Nobody has better gossip in baseball than
Bud. That's right. He is the gossip central. There's no question about that. You know, the second one's my dad. I think that my father only, he was not an advice giver by nature. But he said to me when I went to work at baseball, he said, you know, you should do the job you have and don't worry about the next job and it'll all work out fine. And he was so right about that. I mean, so often around me, I have seen people get focused on, you know, what's next. I'm thinking about my career, what's next. And I think it is a mistake that people make. And then the last one, there was a very senior lawyer at Morgan Lewis by the name of Chuck O'Connor, a Bostonian by birth. And, you know, he was probably the best at the table labor guy, the actual negotiating part of it, more than the lawyer part of it, that I've ever seen. And I learned a tremendous amount about the process from him, how to conduct the process, and really served me well. As you know, I moved over to baseball.
From Boston.
That's right. That's right.
So you've been in the job now 4+ years. And before we get into some of the substance and the meat of the role and what you're working on, you got a chance to sit. We all saw you in Cuba with President Obama. We all know about the famous meeting in the Trump Tower, which you need to talk about. Met U.S. presidents, you've met global CEOs. Have you been starstruck?
You know, I don't really have a recollection of feeling that way. I mean, it is a heady experience to be someplace like in Cuba where, you know, the President Obama said to a group of us, you know, you're a really important, you meaning the sport, Major League Baseball is a really important part of what I'm trying to accomplish here. And, you know, it's not often, I mean, obviously Jackie Robinson breaking the color barriers, another example of it, but every once in a while, a sport gets to be part of something that's bigger than just the sport. You kind of move into the realm where you think you're part of something historic. And I thought at the time in particular that the Cuba trip was really important to what the president was trying to accomplish in terms of opening relations with Cuba.
And day to day now, working with the administration,
Different.
How's that going?
It's different. It is really different. You know, we found the Obama administration to be, particularly in the Cuba setting, to be very disciplined and unified in terms of the messaging. It has been more challenging in terms of working with the Trump administration. We thought, for example, not everybody knows this, we actually made an agreement with the Cuba Baseball Federation, which was very important to us because it created the prospect that a Cuban national could get released from the Cuban system, come to the United States, play in Major League Baseball, and then return to Cuba. If he wanted to during the off season. We thought we had the administration on board with that agreement. We were briefing pretty regularly, and at the late in the process, it appeared that they were not quite so positive about the agreement. So it has been challenging, but we've done some great things with them as well. You know, we've worked with them closely on a number of projects. They've been receptive to concerns we've had, particularly in the with respect to the tax legislation. So, it's been a little different, but generally positive as well.
All right, let's get into the job. You're day-to-day, you're running a $9-plus billion industry. And while you're the boss, everyone has a boss.
Right.
In your case, you've got 30 bosses.
Right.
How the heck do you keep 30 successful, strong-minded baseball owners in line?
You know, people ask about this all the time, and usually it's in the, I use it in the context of what surprised you the most. The management of ownership has been much easier than I would have expected. The group that we have now in ownership is very substantively focused. We have tried to deliver them substance with transparency and participation. We've been tried to be very open about what.
I see John Henry nodded.
That's a good sign. Yeah. Being open about what we're trying to do, giving the owners a meaningful opportunity to participate, has made that governance piece easier than I might have expected. I mean, and it's little things like when we have an owners meeting, the general session is about, you know, 120 people in a room. And it's very difficult to have genuine dialogue when you have that many people in a room. So one of the things I've done is we have that general session, and you know, it is what it is in terms of conveying information. But then I do, as a closing activity to the couple or 3 days that we spend together, a meeting just with the 30 control people. Those are that one individual from each club that actually has the vote under our governance structure. Just me, no staff, and the 30. And in that setting, it's all their peers, right? And they're much more able to tell you what they really think about what you're doing. And that participation, I think, is key to keeping people comfortable with what we're trying to accomplish.
So one of the toughest part of the jobs has to be the fact that you're charged with disciplining your bosses. How does that go?
You're right on that one. The management of them is easier. The disciplining issue is a really, really hard part of the job.
If you're looking to assign that task to someone, I'm happy to take it on.
Yeah, can I tell you something? You wouldn't like it if it was yours.
29 others, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic begins with whatever you're doing to the person that you're disciplining, they feel it's too much. And usually the other 29 feel it's not enough. So it's kind of a no-win proposition. You just have to make your mind up as to what you think the correct outcome is. You have to communicate with the affected individual in advance, so they know what's coming, they understand why you're thinking about the issue the way you're thinking about it. But it's very uncomfortable. And then the last overlay to it, you know, I think of the 30 as a group. You know, we're kind of all bound together in some way. And it's always disappointing when you find yourself in a situation where one of the people in what you regard to be your group has done something that, you know, merits discipline.
So we've worked together for 2+ decades, and one of the things that you did when you took over.
Well, together.
Together.
Sometimes together, sometimes not so together.
That's right. There was a certain incident a couple summers ago, might have involved some Apple Watch activity with the Yankees were stealing signs again. You know, this guy. We went down, and Rob took care of us. One of the things that I watched you do when you came into this role was you started talking a lot about one baseball and trying to create a culture where everyone was pulling in the same direction.
Right.
And the way you did it, at least it appears to those of us at the clubs, was you merged the operations of MLB.com, MLB Network, Major League Baseball Properties, and got everybody sort of on the same page. And as a result of that, you oversaw the sale of BAM Tech, a business we created, to Disney. Right. Now, from media reports, we read that you're at the table once again with Disney. So tell us two things. What's the vision behind this idea, this concept of Major League Baseball getting involved with the regional sports networks, and give us a little color commentary on what it's like to negotiate with Bob Iger.
Okay. Well, the idea behind the regionals, there's an offensive threat, an upside, or in a defensive aspect to the transaction. The forced sale of the regionals, and it truly is forced in the sense Disney wanted these assets that they acquired from Fox. The Department of Justice, in order to approve the larger Disney-Fox transaction, said to Disney, you have to sell these regionals off. It happened at a very inopportune time, in the sense that a number of the potential buyers for those regionals that would have probably been good for our sport were disqualified for one reason or another. You know, AT&T was in the middle of the Time Warner acquisition / litigation. The last thing they were gonna do is try to buy more assets until that was resolved. Comcast had just gotten the Sky deal done, you know, very expensive transaction for them. Probably not an acquirer that quickly on the heels of that transaction. And as a result, the bidders that began to emerge for the regionals were concerning to us. You know, they were largely private equity buyers. The idea, you know, no offense to anybody who works in the private equity business, but, you know, I mean, everybody knows how private equity works. It's a pretty defined model. And the idea of these assets being out there now, private equity buyer in, and then being back on the market 5 to 7 years from now was not that appealing in terms of continuity of delivery of our product to fans. So defensively, we thought, gee, you know, maybe we might be a better option. The offensive side of it is this. A lot of the economic challenges that baseball faces and has faced over the last several decades result from the fact that we generate far more of our revenue locally than any other sport. And we thought gaining control over the RSNs, which derivatively had the rights for, in some cases, the next 25 years of local teams, presented an opportunity to address some of those fundamental economic challenges by more centralization of media rights. And would allow us to get past some of the barriers that we feel in terms of serving our fans. You don't feel it here in Boston. Everybody can watch the Red Sox, but you know there are places around the country where our local television territories leave our fans underserved. I mean, and I'm not talking about places just in the middle of nowhere, like Las Vegas. It's very difficult to watch who you want to watch in Las Vegas. So by accumulating these rights, getting into more of a model where the clubs are equally invested in a central organization, we thought presented an opportunity to address some of those economics, and not only economic, but fan delivery challenges that we'd like to get past.
Yep. Great. And Iger, as a partner of the league and a negotiator?
You know what? Can't say enough good things. In the RSN process, he has been available to us directly. You know, we're kind of partners in this BAMTech thing still. We still own a piece of the business, so there is a relationship there. Very straightforward in the negotiating process, which, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, straight lines in negotiations. You start here, you keep moving towards the middle, that's the way you find a deal. And really decisive about what he's prepared to do.
Great. So let's go back. You talked a little bit about labor and your experiences. August 12th, 1994, I'm a 21-year-old intern for the New York Yankees. I walk into my cubicle, and on my chair there's a memo upside down, and I turn it over, and it's from our general counsel, and it says, to all non-essential personnel, turn in your ID at the Yankee lobby. The game is being shut down. The players are going on strike. So I took two things away from that day. I never want to be non-essential personnel ever again.
It's a good thought, Sam.
Yeah, yeah, that was one thing. Well, you know, I went to Trinity. It was not, not BC, obviously. But the other thing was just the impact of a labor issue on everyone, on the employees of the clubs, the players, their families, the people that work at these ballparks, and just how important labor peace is. And you have been the guy for 25 years negotiating with the Major League Baseball Players Association. So we're in the middle of a CBA now, but we've all been reading a lot about discussions with the union. So just give us a sense of how you think about labor negotiations and sort of how things stand right now as we look to the future.
Yeah, look, I think about, I said this when I talked about going to work for baseball. I think the problem that baseball had for literally decades is they had this kind of hired gun mentality with respect to each negotiation. So, you know, pick your year. You know, they'd go out and hire, you know, Ray Grebe from General Electric or Dick Ravitch, who had done the MTA thing. And, you know, this guy was going to be the answer. So he'd arrive, you know, a year before the negotiation. The union had unbelievable continuity, right? It was Marvin Miller to Don Fear. It was kind of a seamless, you know, same guy selling the same fruit from the same stand for decades, right? And baseball had this hired gun would come in, and you know, it's very hard to understand the basic agreement. It's now 485 pages printed, right? And there's a lot to it. You got to understand not only the agreement itself, but how it interacts with the rules and the politics of the owners. So I think the continuity is a huge thing. And in I think the continuity switch has kind of flipped. You know, my group on the labor side has been there essentially unbroken since 1998. The union, unfortunately, went from Don to Mike Weiner, who was a really talented person. I did two deals really with him. The first one was with Don. But, you know, he unfortunately had brain cancer, passed away. And, you know, yet another change with Tony Clark coming to the helm. So that's been a bit of an issue, to tell you the truth. But I think about it as a process. And it's not just what you do when you're a year away from expiration. It's how you conduct yourself during the term of that agreement. And it's a give and take. It's not, you know, you're stuck. It's like being married, you know? I mean, you're there, for better or for worse. And you got to figure out a way to get along. And so in our current situation, I think that the players are frustrated by certain developments that they have seen under this agreement. And I think of those developments this way. We're spending the same percentage of our revenue on players that we've been spending for, you know, a decade and a half. So the money that's going to them in aggregate is the same. You know, in case you missed it, we did spend $600 million on 630 to be exact on two players last week, set some new records in terms of highest annual salary, total value. So, you know, players are still getting these mega contracts, but the dissatisfaction.
We know about high payrolls here in Boston.
That's right. The dissatisfaction relates to individuals that are getting into the free agent market. That may not be those premier guys and what they're getting in that market. So what I've been trying to do with individual players and with the union is talk about the aggregate economics, the kind of points that I just raised with you, address, and this is a myth about baseball's, you know, profitability. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, we have almost $10 billion in revenue annually, and you know, this is nothing to brag about. I mean, if we have a $300 million EBITDA year, that's a good year for us. I mean, we basically run a break-even business. The owners reinvest in their clubs. So I've tried to make that point to the players and explain to them that, look, you have a distributional problem. It may be that, you know, you think some guys are getting too much, some guys are getting too little, you'd like to create additional opportunities. It's on you to explain to us what you're looking for in terms of distribution of those dollars. Happy to have that conversation. Happy to have it now, not even near expiration. But you have to identify for us what it is that you see as the problem in the system.
Got it. All right, let's look forward. One of the things you said when you took over was you were committed to growing the game and growing the game to a broad audience. You've took us down to Cuba, you've taken us to Mexico, you've taken us to Japan. This summer, the Red Sox and the Yankees are going to play in London, which we're all really looking forward to. Why is international play such a key part of your strategy?
Well, I just think that, you know, we operate in a global environment. You have to make your mind up as to whether you want to be a niche sport that, you know, popular in the United States or North America, taking Canada into account and in a little pocket in, you know, Taiwan, Korea, and Japan, or whether you think you really have a product that can be a worldwide product. We think we have the greatest game in the world, and we think for the game to recognize its true potential, we have to be bigger than just those small pockets where we're really popular already. Baseball faces some tough challenges in that regard because we're an everyday game. You know, we're not going to play, we're not going to permanently have a team in Europe, at least until travel changes from what it is now. But our thought with respect to that is you can have places around the world, and I think the very best one is probably Japan, Taiwan, Korea, right now, where you got a great domestic product. You know, I've gone to you know, NPB games in Japan and Korean games, professional games in Korea. Great atmosphere in their ballparks. You know, really avid fans. You know, making money on the ground, the game being played, and a relationship with Major League Baseball with an appropriate number. And I'll come back and talk about that word appropriate, number of their stars actually move to Major League Baseball, right, and drive interest in Major League Baseball against the backdrop of that domestic product. So appropriate is the balance word, right? Mm-hmm. We want in countries around the world to have a healthy domestic product, enough stars to drive that domestic product in those local sports, but yet the ability for the very best, we think, to come to Major League Baseball and drive interest in what's going on here as well.
That's great. One of the things we've been very focused on under the Henry ownership group has been diversity, inclusion at Fenway Park, not just within our roster makeup, but within the fan base and within our front office base, our employees. You also laid out making sure that we grow the game by reaching out to a diverse fan base and audience. And I know it's a huge goal of yours. You just got a couple nights ago an honor from the Jackie Robinson Foundation. How are things going with respect to that that goal that you laid out there for yourself?
Well, it is an ambitious goal for us. We start from the proposition that the step one is to make sure that we have adequate diversity in the product that we put on the field. You know, we have 35% of our players are from outside the US. So we have great diversity in terms of particularly Latino representation. You know, only 8.5% of our players are African American. That's a number we're working really hard at, and we're working on that number from the grassroots up. And what does that mean? We have invested, when I took over, we spent, you know, literally a pittance on youth initiatives. It is one of our biggest undertakings, biggest areas of investment. It is particularly focused on underserved areas, diverse communities. It involves building youth academies, supporting programs that already exist, developing new ones like the Elite Development Invitational, which is run at Vero Beach, which is where Jackie Robinson went to spring training. We bring in largely, almost exclusively, diverse players from around the country, give them an opportunity to play for 2 weeks with former major league players as their coaches in order to develop that pipeline of talent. And for a relatively, I mean, it's aggressive compared to where we were, but relatively small in terms of our overall business investment, we are seeing great returns. So the last 7 years, 20% of our first round draft choices have been African American, compared to 8.5% in our major league complement. Those first rounders are disproportionately likely to make it to the major leagues. That 20% that I talked about, almost every one of those kids has a touch with a Major League Baseball program, whether it's reviving baseball in the inner cities, the academies, whatever. And that's important to us because we don't think you're going to do the best possible job in terms of diversity in your fan base unless you have adequate diversity on the field. So that's sort of step one. We think another really important issue is what our front offices look like. Being a long-term thinker on these issues, this is another bottom-up initiative for us. We've developed a diversity fellowship program. We actually had, we had 30-something kids in the program, young people, men and women. And our first one just got a permanent job with the Cincinnati Reds. We're looking to build that program out, and we learned some things as we kind of went through the initial stages. I mean, we sponsor 31 Jackie Robinson Foundation scholars every single year, one for each club, one for the commissioner's office. One of the things we learned is we're thinking about all this support. It's good. I mean, we feel good about what we're doing, but we realized we're not hiring any of these Jackie Robinson scholars. And one of the things we came to realize is for two economic reasons, we weren't hiring these young people. Mm. One is they had opportunities from banks and law firms that just frankly were better for them economically. And two, we learned that a lot of our entry-level jobs, we were paying at a rate that if you had, for example, student loans and you didn't have family support, which a lot of these kids did not, it wasn't a living wage. So we've worked really hard on both of those issues to try to make sure that we attract and have in our pipeline qualified A-plus diverse candidates for the clubs to hire.
That's great. Thank you. Well, I think we have a couple of minutes for some questions from the audience. And as you think about your questions, remember that Commissioner Manfred and the Red Sox have given you a gift. So that's the hat you're wearing. So be mindful of that as you ask a question. Any? I see a hand right there. Yes, yes, sir. Randy.
Thanks. Great talk. What are your thoughts on the current recruiting process of for U.S. citizens of high school seniors getting drafted as opposed to going into MLB? And then do you see the kind of second door of that 21-year-old age staying in place?
Yeah, you know, the relationship with, I was actually mentioning this to Father Leahy, the relationship with college baseball is something that we have worked, or let me say it this way, we've spent a lot of time trying to improve. College baseball is a challenge for us. Frankly, the more kids that we could get to go to college, probably better for us over the long haul. Unfortunately, 11.7 is one of the most puzzling numbers to me on an ongoing basis. Why it is we have 11.7 college scholarships available is a real competitive issue for baseball vis-a-vis other sports, right? Because if you only have 11 scholarships or 11.7 in a college baseball program, it puts you at a competitive disadvantage when you're competing for athletes that can play multiple sports. okay? So that's one problem. Secondly, we don't relish the idea of buying kids out of their college education, that is signing them as high school seniors. But the reality is that college baseball underperforms, and so what we've done is made available to kids that we do sign as high schoolers a college scholarship program to try to encourage them to get their education even though they've elected to play baseball. The junior rule, I actually think when you look at where other professional sports are, that is the ability to sign after your junior year, I actually think is a pretty good balance. I really do. To say to a kid, if you go to college, you have to stay there 4 years, I think you're going to lose more kids going to college. So I think that the junior and out rule is probably a fairly good balance, given the economic realities that we're dealing with in terms of scholarship availability at NCAA Division I programs.
I think we've got time for one more question.
I just want to say first, thank you for the hat. Appreciate that a lot.
All right.
I thought you were going to say thanks for coming.
Well, I appreciate that too. I just had a couple of questions. One, I've been fascinated by this sort of nexus of baseball in Asia, especially Japan. I was kind of curious how that ever started. Mm-hmm. And do you see internationally another area? Is it going to be Europe or would it be, I don't know, India or what do you see? And the other, this is not a trick question, but I am interested. If you had a qualifying woman to play baseball, could she?
Yeah, of course. I have to tell you, let me do the woman thing first, because I think it's important. We have every place, and I forget to say this sometimes, I'm going to have to be better about it. Every place that we've invested in the youth space, in baseball, we have also invested an equal amount of money and effort in softball, and really interestingly, in girls baseball. We had the first ever MLB-sponsored girls baseball tournament in California a couple of summers ago. We repeated it last year. There is, everything you do, you learn something. There is a certain appeal to playing exactly the same game that we probably didn't fully appreciate until we got out there and started doing it. I went down to the Little League World Series right after I got elected. It happened to be the Monet Davis year. Mm. I saw her in Little League. You know, she was really one of the stars of that event. She actually was still playing. Now, this is 3 years later. She was in a boys' high school tournament that we ran at the All-Star Game in Washington last year, still pretty darn competitive. So, it could happen, if with the right athlete, 100%. With respect to, international development is an interesting thing. We've tried to think about our international strategy country by country, okay? So let's talk about two you mentioned, London and India, okay? We see London, we're taking our very best, in June, and we're gonna follow it up with another of our very best, the Cubs and the Cardinals. Why are we doing that? We think it's important to generate buzz around that event, those events, because we believe there is an immediate economic broadcast opportunity in Europe that if we develop enough interest, we actually can capitalize on that opportunity. India is an entirely different effort. We just started a program this year that's going to be in 300 schools. The effort there, because there's no baseball culture, right? None at all, zero, is to start from the ground up, try to get people familiar with the game. We'll couple that school program with what really, this is a pejorative word, but it's I was going to say dumping content, but it's making available free baseball content as an adjunct to getting people playing the game so people could become familiar with it, and then you make a judgment as to how you're going to take the next step from there.
Well, I just want to close by obviously thanking Commissioner Manfred for being here, but also a huge thank you to this business community that has supported the Red Sox year in and year out. in a way that we don't, commissioner doesn't see in every market around the country. So huge thanks to you on behalf of everyone at the Red Sox and Major League Baseball. Thank you, Rob. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Rob Manfred, Commissioner of Major League Baseball. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.